So, first of all, just thanks so much for coming this morning. You know, I really appreciate it. I think there's some amazing talks to go to, and I'm a little bit surprised that I showed up myself. You know, there's some really interesting things to hear about this morning and through the last couple of days. So, I really appreciate your interest in coming. So, I'm going to talk about my perspective on a future. But not too distant future. We're talking about maybe within the next decade, treatment for major mental illnesses that has to do with the focal, titratable correction of symptom-related alterations in brain circuit activity. And I can say that this isn't the title that Steve Garrow was he was my handler, you know, and he was like working on making things more approachable. But I was scared of him because he's a hockey player, you know, he's not here. And so I could say whatever I want, and he had to run to a graduation today, so I'm going to try to find the right balance between being approachable, but not talking down to anybody, and I'm sure I'll make mistakes on both sides some of the time, but really feel free to like call me out on it and just say, wait, you know, I don't get that, or if you think, you know, if you hear something that I say that just seems wrong. Whether it's wrong in some kind of ethical way or wrong in a scientific way, feel free to just you know, raise your hand, shout out. I think this would be a lot more fun and useful if it's interactive. I only prepared about 20 slides, so I hope that you know, I'll be done with my yada yada by maybe 9:30 or so, and we'll have lots of discussion. Or what would be even better if we kind of discuss as we go. Either way. I hope that there'll be lots of discussion. One other thing I wanted to say is that the stuff I'm going to talk about is you know, very deadly serious, and I know that very well, and I imagine that quite a few of you know that very well. At the same time, I think I try to keep a certain level of levity, in a sense, even though that's kind of weird when you're talking about such devastating illnesses. I do that partly because it's sort of my personal style, but I also think it helps for communication in a context like this some. And so I apologize in advance if I offend anybody with a sense of levity, because I understand how serious the subject matter is. At the same time, I want to try to keep it that way and optimistic because I think that helps communication. Okay, so... I'm going to just say a little bit about, first I have to do this, try this. So I work at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and I'm on the Conflict of Interest Committee. We recently spun off a $700 million company, and I am acutely aware of the challenges of conflicts of interest in the modern academic, corporate, medical scenarios. I have no conflicts to declare. I drive a Ford, and I'm good, you know. So just to kind of run a little bit through my own background. Here at Amherst, I came to Amherst because at the time, to my knowledge, it was the planet's only neuroscience department with a neuroscience program embedded in a neuroscience department, which is pretty weird for 1980. Actually, Penn developed one in about 81. But at that time, you could do neuroscience in many different academic areas, but it was a multi-departmental combinatorial thing rather than having a department of neuroscience. And I thought that was pretty cool and was a part of the reason that I came here. So I majored in neuroscience and psychology. I minored in rowing and in chi-fi. And I have to say that the life skills I learned at Chi Phi were in good stead last night when I went to bed around 10:30 while a raging party was going on about 8 feet away in the common room. It's life skills. Then I went to Yale to tech in a lab at the Connecticut Mental Health Center. It was an epilepsy-oriented lab in rats. I also volunteered at the Yale Psychiatric Institute. I worked with inpatient adolescents who were suffering from psychosis, many of them on their first break, and mostly tried to do SAT prep. These kids were trying to stay in life. they were quite disturbed, but it gave me a really interesting and useful perspective and what the challenges are to be 15, 16, 17 and suffering in this way. I then went to University of Connecticut, and only school I applied to. I lived at home. I had a job. I was a rowing coach. And that way I could get out of med school without any loans, which is critical for being able to do the path that I later have been taken. And be perfectly comfortable with my Ford, you know, because I didn't owe $300,000 after getting done with med school. Then I did a lot of fellowships at the NIMH, mostly with children, attention deficit disorder, other things. I then also took a year off to torture my parents. I worked in a mountain village in Guatemala for a good chunk of that. Then I eventually came back to the Ivory Tower, went to University of Pittsburgh for a psychiatry residency. I did schizophrenia research, kind of focused on schizophrenia clinically, postmortem research on schizophrenia, and also adolescent monkey neocortex development. I went out to California to UCSF for a postdoctoral fellowship, and I was an assistant professor kind of with training wheels there for a few years. And there was critical for my training was learning how to manipulate genes. This was relatively early days of if you want to change a gene, you can do it in a mouse. So if you find a gene or a handful of genes that are maybe relevant to schizophrenia, you can make a mouse version of those genetic abnormalities and then see how it affects mouse brain development or behavior. And so that's what I was learning how to do there. It's kind of funny because now, I mean, everybody in science can say this more or less, but none of the stuff I learned is at all relevant anymore. Conceptually, yeah. But it took us, you know, months to years to make a mouse back then, and now we can do it in literally weeks. You know, we can make the genetic alterations in a dish in 1 week, and then we can, you know, make a change to mouse sperm within a handful of weeks, and then we can inject that sperm into a pregnant mouse and get babies within less than a month. So we can go soup to nuts in maybe 3 months in what would have been about a 2-year process back when I was doing this in the 90s. Then I went to Cornell Med to start my lab, and I had a schizophrenia clinic on the Upper East Side, focusing on treatment-resistant schizophrenia, mostly the medication clozapine. And I also studied mouse neurogenetics and started doing work in human stem cells as that system became available, where we can manipulate genes in human stem cells and then study human cells that we generate out of those stem cells. And that's most of what my lab actually does now. I moved to Chopin Pen 7 years ago, and I stopped doing clinical work because they asked me to take on administrative roles, and I couldn't do that and run a lab and see patients, so that's what I do now. All right, so this is just an overslide of how do major mental illnesses work, and the point here is that actually we now know quite a lot about how different major mental illnesses work, and I'm talking about depression. But the kind of depression that's really life-threatening, where people can't get out of bed, they can't stop thinking about ending their lives, they're absolutely hopeless, a little bit of like what Sylvia Plath describes so beautifully in her book, The Bell Jar, where you're kind of at the bottom of a well looking up, and all you see is the roof of the well. You can't look out. You don't realize there's any sun anywhere, and there's no hope. So that kind of major mental illness, or obsessive compulsive disorder, I'll talk about a little bit. What we're talking about, not the people who have to check maybe, you know, a dozen times before they can leave the house, but we're talking about people who wash their hands hundreds of times a day and they can't leave the house. Or they have to go back and check the oven hundreds of times a day and they're stuck. So people who have a debilitating life impacting illness. And then I'm going to talk about schizophrenia as another very major mental illness. So in terms of all of these disorders, we actually know quite a lot about circuitry abnormalities in these abnormalities. I don't have anywhere near enough time to kind of go into a lot on the circuitry. I'm going to focus a little bit on one part related to schizophrenia. But I want to communicate that at this point, although the information is massive because the problems are not simple and all these disorders are heterogeneous, there's multiple ways to get to that particular endpoint. But the neurobiology and the circuitry biology and some of the genetics for this stuff is actually getting to be worked out pretty well, which is really cool because that allows us to start to formulate better hypotheses for now how we can fix it if we understand what's wrong. So this is just a general sense of major mental illnesses, from my perspective, are circuitry abnormalities and brain development and brain function. Oh, I just got this off the web, and it is, these are just random numbers. I think they put in for some kind of circuit that somebody picked off of whatever motherboard that controls, you know, air traffic control or who knows what. Although it would be clever, one could probably put in specific gene variants that regulate different regions of the brain that are shown on there. One could actually do that, but it would take a while. Okay, so anyway, this is how major mental illnesses work, and this is how pills work. And my point here is that when you think about trying to fix a circuit, you know, a specific circuit, something's going on down here in people with OCD in the orbital frontal cortex, or something's going on in the ventral hippocampus in people with schizophrenia with lots of psychosis, or something's going on in the frontal cortex for people with depression, also in the hippocampus, they're relatively specific problems. We're going to try to fix those problems by taking a pill, putting it in your mouth, it goes to your stomach, it gets distributed to every tissue in your body, and some component of that distribution includes an effect on the specific circuit that you want to change in order to get a therapeutic effect. So to some extent, if you know if we're going to try to do something, you'd think, like, wow, that's crazy. It's amazing that that ever works. And it's cool that it does work. You know, it's really amazing. It really does help. The medications for major mental illnesses can be incredibly helpful. On the other hand, and particularly in schizophrenia, the medications don't really work any better now than they did in the 60s. And that is not an exaggeration. There's been lots of studies on efficacy. The percentage of people that get better with medications really hasn't changed since the 60s. The side effects are quite a bit better. So people will take them more, and it's easier to get younger people to take them because the side effects are better. So I think there's been progress because of the side effect profiles, but the efficacy is essentially unchanged for almost 50 years. And there's a sort of a discussion we could have about why that might be. My bias, and I've said this, there was a big thing at the New York Annals, New York Psychiatric Association, where I guess deputy director of the FDA and sort of sociological neuroscientists were there pontificating about what is wrong with the system, that why we haven't come up with better meds. And I couldn't stand it. I finally, in the question period, kind of got up and had to say in front of this ballroom full of people, it's not necessarily the system. It's the brain. The problem is the brain isn't designed in a way where you have very, very selective receptors and signaling mechanisms doing very, very selective things. The brain is set up like a huge building. And yeah, the mail room is different from the pumping room, which is different from the electrical room, which is different from the boardroom. But the components in the walls are incredibly similar everywhere. The basic switches, the basic foundations. And so finding specificity that a drug is going to be able to affect, it goes everywhere in your body, but only going to affect one thing, you got to be pretty optimistic. And the more we learn about the brain, the more we learn about how certain switches and signaling systems are used again and again in different systems at different times, it's not surprising that it's not hard, not easy to find drugs that have specific enough effects, that don't have side effects that make it impossible to use, even though it works great in a dish and works great in a mouse. Mark? Yes.
So it seems that if the pharmaceutical industry was able to produce a drug that actually just worked on part of the brain for schizophrenia, there would be very little off-label use for that drug. I don't want to be so cynical, but it seems to me that a lot of these drugs that affect the brain are being also used for purposes that are perhaps not the intended original purpose. And so these pharmaceutical industries can make money off it.
I think it's a fair point for some of the rare disorders. Schizophrenia is common enough that the market is huge. And Paul Janssen, I guess his name, in the 1990s, sat down at his computer and made the first computer-based antipsychotic. What he did was he looked at the structure of antipsychotics. They block dopamine D2 and D4 receptors. But a lot of them have difficult side effects. And so he looked at the structure of the molecule on his computer. He synthesized 1,000 different compounds. He then tested those compounds, first in dishes and then in animals. And he came up with one compound, risperidone. Janssen has made billions of dollars with that one medication, the vast majority of its use has been in psychosis. Not necessarily schizophrenia. Sometimes it's also used in people with other types of psychotic problems. But it's been an incredibly successful drug. And so that's sort of a counterexample. At least in schizophrenia, it's so common, 1 in 100 people worldwide, that this problem of off-label use and whether they're attracted to it is not a problem for this particular thing. So, and I'm not saying that people won't invent new medications that will be better than what we have for schizophrenia. I'm not giving up on that myself. I'm just saying that I think to some extent it's the problem is the brain rather than the system. Okay, so what other approaches are coming that are focal or in active use? I'm going to show two examples of focal approaches, non-medication approaches, that are in active use in the United States now, and in Europe, and Canada, and Mexico, and lots of countries. And the first one is a transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is used for depression. And so you probably remember that, you know, the way power plants work is you spin a magnet or you have a pulsating activity of a magnet, and that drives an electrical field. And so this is basically pulsating magnets here, and they'll create an electrical field. And the way you vary that electrical field, you can actually increase or decrease activity in the brain within a few centimeters underneath the place that you're hitting with the magnet, or affecting with the magnet. Since many people with depression have decreased activity in the right frontal lobe, you can use this to increase the activity in that area in a way that doesn't cause a seizure and can greatly improve people's symptoms. I think there's a lot that's not really known about exactly why this works, to tell you the truth. But the fact that it works is very well established. This is FDA approved. Insurance companies pay for it, and a lot of people are benefiting from it. In ways where they don't have side effects from medications of antidepressants, which can be a pretty big problem. And this is just sort of an example. You know, when things have gotten mainstream, when the advertising starts getting more sophisticated. And like, so this is like, you know, 5 out of 6 dentists surveyed, you know, chew sugarless gum, you know, sort of thing. And this is the basic TMS, you know. The guy looks like he just had a lobotomy or something, you know. And this is the NeuroStar TMS, you know, where you know, looks a lot healthier, no skull cap, and you know, things are just great here. So this is to say that this field is moving forward in a very real way. There's money to be made, and there's people to be helped with the system. Sir?
When that is used, is the idea that it will change whatever area of the brain that it's affecting permanently, or is it's not just while that machine is sitting on?
Yeah, great question. So the effect lingers, and the length of the lingering of the effect varies across different people, and that's still something that's an active area of our research of what's the best paradigm, and there probably isn't a single best paradigm. Probably different people are different. Kind of back to that bell jar or bottom of the well scenario. Some people, when they get back out of the well, and they can actually maintain themselves at not a depressed state by doing lifestyle changes, better exercise, better diet. The microbiome, the stuff in your gut affects your brain. And so sometimes once you lift up, you can actually use other methods to stay healthy. For some people, it's just chemical, and they're going to get sick again no matter what they do. So there's a mix of that. But still, so there are people that they think will need chronic treatment. And they're now thinking about doing implantations of various things or wearing like a helmet where you don't even have to go to the doctor anymore to give yourself this TMS.
So I thought
about whether to present ECT, and I decided, well, I didn't present ECT because, you know, really ECT isn't focal. The initial ECT, they went bipolar. Secondary, more modern ECT, last 30 years or so, it's been like this. But really the goal of ECT is to create a seizure, which is the whole body. And any way in which you create a seizure, it has therapeutic effects. In the 30s, they used insulin to give people an insulin shock seizure, and could see benefits for both depression and psychosis, even though, I mean, you can imagine how primitive that is, and also people would die sometimes.
Sir, can I just hear you? I think you said the right frontal part of the brain, but these folks are getting treated on the left.
Okay. No, yeah, and that's my bad. Well, it depends on the individual, but I think that so they're going on the left. That's a good point. I would tell you know, honestly, I don't do this, and I focus on psychosis, not depression. So, The right frontal brain has lower activity in depression, and I'm pretty confident about that. But if it makes more sense to do the TMS on the left side, because that's where the language centers are, and that might be more of a seat of consciousness. Maybe they feel more consciously activated that way. So I'm willing to, good point. You know, again, it's out of my my wheelhouse, not having ever really used this technique myself. So I think that overall they're saying that, you know, you can't find defects as long as you don't overdo it. You can create seizures with it if you overdo it. So that would be one end of an extreme. And any time there's a relatively new treatment, it's likely that you're going to find people that have negative effects of it in the long run. I can give one anecdote of such an effect that was done from a study that was started at Harvard now quite a while ago, I think almost 20 years ago, where they were treating hallucinations in patients. So when people with schizophrenia have hallucinations, their left auditory cortex is actually very active. So that when they tell you it sounds like a voice, that's because it sounds like a voice, because the part of their brain that would be hearing a voice and transducing that signal is blazing, firing away. So you can suppress that activity with TMS, and you can turn the hallucinations off. And so they did a study of a group of patients, and it was double-blinded, so they had sort of a sham treatment, a treatment. They used patients that had been very seriously affected for many years, so that medications weren't really helpful. They had been chronically hearing voices for many years. And when they did that, they could suppress the voices. The problem was when they did this crossover and started using the sham treatment, the voices came back. And when the voices came back, they were really, really nasty. And they had two suicides. And the voices seemed to be angry for having been suppressed, and literally came back in a way where people, you know, were experienced like the worst they'd ever had in their life. So you can imagine, and now I haven't heard in depression that that's an issue where you get a rebound effect from when not having it, and then you get even more depressed. But I might wonder whether that could happen to some people if it's not monitored closely. All right, so next thing I want to just run through quickly, also something that I don't do, but I wanted to give you a couple of examples of things that are happening before we get into the stuff that's sort of the future thing. And so this is called deep brain stimulation. In this case, there's basically a pacemaker. It's very similar to people with a pacemaker for the heart. And then the electrode is run under the skin, under the neck, up to the scalp, and attached to an electrode, which is a piece of metal that goes down through the scalp into the brain. And so the electrical signal from here, instead of affecting the heart, is going to affect activity in a particular parts of the brain. And this is a widely used treatment now. I think that the main place it's being used is in Parkinson's disease and other movement disorders. But it's also being used in very severe cases of obsessive compulsive disorder, and is also an approved treatment that does work for some people. For people like, you know, they do 1,000 push-ups a day, their shoulders are going to just collapse. And they can't, again, leave the house, and they get treated, and then they can actually live. And these are people for whom medications hasn't been helpful. So it's a really scary thought to kind of put an electrode in your brain and try to change activity in a focal way like this. But on the other hand, I think that the field of neuroscience is getting to a point where we have enough of a clue in some cases about what circuitry is abnormal to be able to do this effectively. Clearly, that's true for Parkinson's. I got this off the Boston Children's website, of a treatment they're using for a particular rare kind of dystonia, where one has sort of a spasticity, they can't relax their muscles, and this kind of treatment is something that they kind of are very publicly offering. This is real, it's happening today, and it's being used both in psychiatry, but especially in neurology right now, but it's going to be used increasingly in psychiatry going forward. So yeah, great question and a good sort of segue. So right now, my understanding is that the main treatments are, you set it, you give a setting, and then it runs, and then you go see your doc and they can make adjustments. However, with phones, now people are starting to look into actually having the phone regulating, titrating the level of the stimulation, and in real time beaming back to the clinician. And you can use the phone to tell how much people are checking, right? You can tell if someone's going back and checking the house 15 times by the movements of the phone. And so now you can try to use that to either have the phone directly titrate it, or alert the clinician to say, hey, buddy, you know, are you running into trouble right now? Everything okay? Maybe we need to tweak this a little bit. So this is also coming. In epilepsy, which is something that really is coming, this is being worked on by a guy named Dan Licht at Penn, but it's also the big group at UCSF doing this and others, where when you start to have a seizure, the brain waves change before the seizure starts. And so using this kind of deep brain stimulation and activating inhibitory centers of the brain, people are starting to use a sensor that says, uh-oh, seizure coming in 5 seconds. Bam, activate that inhibitory center, stop the seizure from happening. That's a little freaky, you know? I mean, it's not quite at the point where the electrodes are measuring people's thoughts before they have them, but they're getting in that direction. Okay, so what about schizophrenia? I want to just describe really quickly what schizophrenia is. First symptoms of schizophrenia tend to be weird, intrusive thoughts. And I use weird thoughtfully because most of the people that are affected by schizophrenia, they experience the thoughts as weird. Most of them react initially to what's happening to them in a way that any of us would react. They realize, am I going crazy? This is really weird. They withdraw. And then eventually, a lot of times, they kind of crystallize into having some specific weird thing that's going on. Submarines off the coast of California are using me in an experiment of some new kind of subspace communication, you know, some very specific thing. But it starts off as weird, intrusive thoughts a fair amount of time. Most people experience voice hallucinations. Reduced mental quickness and working memory problems is a major part of the problem and something that you can measure happening in people before they really get diagnosed with schizophrenia. Is a drop of mental capacity, particularly working memory, the ability to keep one thing online while you're doing something else, like finish a sentence. And then also there's a reduced enjoyment, social isolation. It generally starts very slowly. It generally starts in the mid to late teens. A lot of times people don't ever come to care for 3 to 5 years after symptoms really started, though. So it often hits care in the 20s. And then 1% of the world population, so a lot of people affected. 70% risk of identical twin, 10% risk of parent or sib, and so it's heavily genetic. But there are over 150 gene variants already identified that increase risk of schizophrenia. So it's a very heterogeneous type of problem. It's not like Huntington's disease where we know the Huntington gene. And incidentally, I remember being at Amherst, and I think it was Robin Gottdinger. Do you remember that in Ratner's class in 1983, we had a journal club-like class, and you presented on Huntington. The Huntington gene had just been discovered in a large pedigree from Venezuela, and you did a brilliant presentation, and we were all like, this is so cool. It's 1983, and we know the Huntington's gene. It's just around the corner that we're going to cure Huntington's disease. Ah! You know, why, you know, gee. 35 years later, or you know, or more, now you know. Of course, people are getting closer, and actually, some of the technology I'm going to show you in a second is really going after Huntington's disease quite a bit. And so maybe there is hope. But gee, this stuff is hard, even if you know the gene. Okay, so back to antipsychotic medication for schizophrenia. About a third improve substantially, and by substantially, I mean they can really pretty much get on with their lives again. Usually some of that mental slowness, they get a hit there. So a lot of times their life trajectory isn't going to be the same as they might have been in terms of their mental capacity. But we're still talking about people with families and jobs and you know, productive lives. About a third improve some. So their lives are not productive so much, but they don't need to be in the hospital all the time. And they can live and enjoy aspects of life. And more of a kind of a walking wounded kind of situation. And then about a third improve very little or not at all. And as I mentioned, this hasn't really changed since the 60s. About a third of people, their management is really dependent upon their behavior. So if they can live on a farm or if they can live in New York City and not cause too much trouble for people, They can live outside or in a shelter or homeless or whatever, but they are constantly hallucinating, constantly delusional, and medications don't seem to make any difference whatsoever. There is some controversy over that. My reading of the literature is that not much. There is a tendency in science, although I love all the people that say that, like all these scientists that believe in global warming, it's groupthink. I can tell you, you get rewarded as a scientist for being the one who thinks differently, not the one who thinks the way everybody else does. So that's how you get your papers in Nature and Science, is by changing the paradigm, not by just going along with it. So, and now there is a tendency in every field, including in schizophrenia, that people say, schizophrenia is going up because of something, and then they get all famous for something, and then, 5-10 years goes by, and it's maybe not so much. My perspective is it hasn't changed much. There is one area in which there is some reason to think that schizophrenia could be changing, and that has to do with marijuana. There's been three different studies, different groups, two different continents, two of them really good studies, one of them kind of meh, which showed that if you're less than 16 years old and you're exposed to relatively regular marijuana, and you have a first-degree relative, parent or sibling, with schizophrenia, your risk goes from 10% to 30%. So that's a big jump. But that group of people is only a small fraction of the people with schizophrenia. Most people with schizophrenia don't have relatives, a first-degree relative with the illness. So that wouldn't necessarily have a big effect on the total rate of schizophrenia in the population. But it is a bit of a red flag. I'm happy to discuss that more. We're working on something related to that that I'd love to sort of discuss if there's time, or we could chat about it after. But I want to go on in the main thing here first. All of the medications have side effects. It's always a battle to try to figure out how low you can go. You want the medication to be as little as possible so side effects are minimized so people will take it, but not go below a threshold where they get sick again. And what's tricky about it is it's a little bit driving a super tanker in the night where you don't exactly have landmarks. So you might turn the wheel a little bit. You don't really know how much that tanker is moving until it's too late to move it back. And so if you go too low, sometimes then people slip into a psychosis and then they don't take their meds because they're psychotic. And then you lose a lot of ground that you might have been making and helping somebody in their life. You can imagine just how far you can fall when you go too low. But on the other hand, you go as low as you can. So this is constant trying to get it as right as possible. But everybody has side effects. Okay, so now I'm going to switch into the stuff that a little bit more about that future part that my lab is involved with. One of the things that has been identified, and this was done first in the UK in the early 90s, and has been done a bunch of times by different groups, is that there's a particular part of the brain in people with schizophrenia that's consistently hyperactive. And the level of hyperactivity, it correlates nicely with the level of psychosis that they report. And this is called the hippocampus part of the brain, especially this anterior hippocampus part of the brain, is hyperactive on brain scans. And this isn't true for everybody with schizophrenia. Schizophrenia, again, is a very broad word. It doesn't describe one illness. It describes a constellation of illnesses that we lump together and give a name, schizophrenia. So there's many people with schizophrenia that will have this activation of the anterior hippocampus. And the more they have that activation, the less strong their cognition is, and the more they have hallucinations. Okay, this is a correlation, so that doesn't mean it has anything to do with affecting those symptoms. It could just be a correlation and nothing more. So my lab's done a couple of studies, and other labs have done this too. I'm presenting this from sort of my lab's perspective. If there's ever a case where it takes a village, in science, it takes a village. There's a bunch of labs doing this, and everybody builds off of each other. So I'm just showing you a couple of examples of papers at my lab collaborated with others. We're kind of a stem cell lab, so we make stem cells in these inhibitory neurons. This part of the brain is hyperactive in people with schizophrenia. So in a mouse model, that's a genetic model that causes the same hippocampal hyperactivation. No, the mice don't have schizophrenia. But what the mice do have is frontal set-shifting abnormalities. When you teach them one rule and then they have to change and learn another rule, they're terrible at it, and so are people with schizophrenia. They have social working memory problems I'm going to talk about in a sec. They have a whole constellation of problems that you also see in schizophrenia, but we can't tell whether they're hearing voices, of course, so we're not ever claiming that this is a schizophrenic mouse. So in one study with the mouse, another study with the rat, and this is a completely different model. The rats get a toxin in utero, and they develop also a constellation of abnormalities after adolescence, actually not till they're young adult rats, that also mirror the cognitive problems that people with schizophrenia suffer. They also have hippocampal hyperactivation. Now, in both of these models, we could fix their abnormalities in the adult by putting more inhibitory neurons into that ventral hippocampus part of the brain in adults. So that's pretty cool. You know, I mean, the idea that they have a developmental abnormality, these guys have a genetic abnormality causing too few of the inhibitory cells to be born. So they're abnormal from birth. But we can fix their behavior problems as adults by adding inhibition, in this case by cells that are inhibitory, into this hippocampal part of the brain. But, you know, that's all very exciting. And in fact, my postdoc mentor, John Rubenstein, formed a company called Neurona out of UCSF with a couple other UCSF professors, and he invited me to come out and be the chief scientific officer of this new company, which I think now has a capitalization of about $50 million. They're trying to create a company that's going to be like the source of inhibitory neurons to treat everything from epilepsy to psychosis to a whole bunch of stuff. And I wish them well. Personally, I didn't go for it, partly because my better half is Hungarian and doesn't want to live on the left coast, partly because she and I both think that probably this isn't such a wise approach in the long run. This isn't really ideal. Putting cells into someone's brain, you know, it's hard to control once they're in there, you know. So what would be the ideal approach? If you know there's a focal circuit in the brain, a fairly defined area that's, say, hyperactive or hypoactive, what would be the best way to try to fix that circuit? Okay, and so that's what I want to show you now. So what we want to do is target a specific area. And ideally, even better than that, we want to target it in a way where we can adjust the level to which the change we're making is actually being administered. Okay? So we want to actually do something where either with an inhaler up the nose or with a medication in the mouth, we can affect the activity in a very specific part of the brain that we have changed on purpose. That's the thing. And that's what's happening. Not yet in patients for schizophrenia, but it's actually happening in patients for a couple other things. And so that's what I want to present, and that's what I think is really neat. How to focally, titratably, so you can adjust it, manipulate brain circuit activity. And now here's where it gets a little wonky. And I love that word because I love to read Krugman, and I never understand a word he's saying, you know. But he says this gets wonkish, you know. He's like, and I always try, and I never get it. So these things are called designer receptors exclusively activated by designer drugs, or DREDs. They started to be generated in the early 1980s, actually. The idea that you have an artificial receptor, it doesn't exist in biology, and therefore you can't have an off-target effect. As if you have a drug that only activates it, it's not going to activate anything else because that receptor doesn't exist anywhere else. It's an artificial receptor. And you link that artificial receptor, in the case of a neuron, with ion channels that will cause a neuron either to become more excited or less excited. So it's an artificial designer receptor that you can use to turn the activity neuron up or down based on the drug that you give, and you can give as much of that drug as you want. So you can turn it up a little or you can turn it up a lot. The other concept that's made this thing doable is the adeno-associated virus. The adeno-associated virus is a ubiquitous virus in humans, and it's kind of cool because you know how viruses normally, you kind of like the one that I got on my nose now. Probably also an adenovirus. So they'll get into a cell, and then they get into the nucleus, and then they make more copies of the proteins they need to make a capsid molecule, and then the guts of it so they can replicate themselves, and then they shoot out of the cell and infect the next cell. The AAV virus is a total cheater. It doesn't have the capacity to make more of itself. It uses another virus. So if you already have an adenovirus, the adeno-associated virus is just a little piece of DNA that comes along and says, hey, can I borrow your polymerase for a minute? I need a little help here. And so it requires the help of a second virus in order to make more copies of itself. Since most people won't have that other virus and it can be further tweaked so it can't be activated, it's actually incredibly safe because it can't infect anything. It's incapable of that. It needs help, and then you can modify it a little more so it even can't be helped. So it's a very safe kind of virus. You can package about 4,000 base pairs of DNA in it, which isn't a ton, but it's enough so that you can do a gene therapy with it. And you can do that gene therapy in a way where it'll only express in certain types of cells, say excitatory cells or inhibitory cells, but not both. So because if we're going to try to tone things down, it won't work if we're going to tone down the inhibitory ones and the excitatory ones. We want to selectively tone down the excitatory ones, say in the hippocampus, or maybe some other situation we want to selectively upregulate the inhibitory ones. And so you can do all that by tweaking the DNA sequences in the adenovirus. All right, so here's another little very tiny wonky part. Actually, it's mostly wonky from here on out. So if you have any questions, you know, until the final slide. So I want to skip this so we have time. This is a genetic abnormality, 22q deletion syndrome. It's about 1 in 4,000, so it's pretty common. CHOP has one of the world's largest clinics of people with 22q. They have various abnormalities. The children develop GI problems and heart problems, and also many of them have cognitive delay. But the remarkable thing about it, in addition to the other problems, is that 20-30% develop schizophrenia. They develop real, looking like everybody else's schizophrenia. That's a huge number, by far the highest genetic risk for schizophrenia is to have this 22q deletion syndrome. And so we have a mouse that has the 22q deletion syndrome. And the mice have the same kind of cognitive deficits that we've seen, that I mentioned that the rat and that other mouse model have. They also have ventrohippocampal hyperactivity, but I don't want to waste time going through that with you. You'll have to trust me on that. So they have ventrohippocampal hyperactivity in these 22q mice. This is a collaboration with a professor at CHOP and Penn, Doug Coulter, who's an electrophysiology whiz, epilepsy guy. I'm very proud to say Doug has never worked on schizophrenia before, and this is my goal in life, is to get as many people to work on schizophrenia as possible. And Julia Kahn is a grad student in his lab who's finishing up now but has done most of the work that I'll show. My lab has done some. How do you measure cognition in a mouse that's relevant to schizophrenia? So one of the things we do is social memory. It's a very simple test. So if you put a mouse in a box and it has two choices, it has a novel object it doesn't know and a mouse it doesn't know, the normal mouse will spend more time with the mouse than the object. You know, they're social animals, and so they'll go over and they'll sniff out the other mouse, and they'll go check out the object a little bit, and you can measure how much time they spend on either side, very quantitative. And so you do this, and this is important to do in the beginning. So our 22q mice, they're fine at this. They're much more interested in the mouse than the object. Other models, say an autism-related model mouse, would say, I don't care about that mouse, or I don't even want to be by that mouse. What is that object? That looks really cool. So you can use this to study things on the autism, and it's not studying psychosis, but we're studying a cognitive deficit you see in people with psychosis, which is social memory. Okay, so the 22q mice prefer the mouse over the object. So then they get to know Herbie really well for a while. You separate them for half an hour. Now you put them back in the cage, and Herbie, the one they already know, is in one of the two, and you kind of switch back their positions back and forth. But the other one has a new mouse. Now, a normal mouse will spend more time with a new mouse than the mouse that already knows. It says, oh, I know you. I'm going to go over and check you out. But the 22q mice are terrible at this. They spend equal amounts of time with both mice. They don't seem to remember. Now, that's sort of we're guessing that they don't remember the mouse they met 2 hours ago, or maybe they just don't care. We have to anthropomorphize here and say, oh, they don't remember. That's what people usually say. I don't know whether they remember or not. But I can measure it, though, and they clearly don't discriminate between the two mice, unlike a normal mouse would. And that is a function of activity in the ventral hippocampus, shown by Susumu Nagawa's lab at MIT first. Okay, so what we're doing then is, and this is just our AAV virus, It has a particular element that allows it to the expression of the inserted gene to only occur in excitatory cells, so we don't want it occurring in the inhibitory cells. We want it, and then this is a construct that will be the DREAD receptor conjugated with a inhibitory ion channel. So this is what turns down the activity, and this is just a fluorescent protein so that we know where we put the virus and whether it got it in the cells it was supposed to and is expressing appropriately. So this is the virus. This tells it to only express in excitatory cells. This tells it to downregulate it when we give it the drug in the mouth or inject it, and this is the fluorescent marker. And then Julia injects these into the ventral hippocampus of these 22q mice that have hyperactivity in this area that she's shown in other ways that I'm not saying. And so this is what she found. So so here's, again, the test, and the mouse is then, we give the drug. In this case, there's no drug. The 22q mice don't discriminate, so they spend most of their time in between the two. They go to one, they go to the other, but they don't bias themselves towards one or the other, so that their number is down near zero, whereas the control mouse spends almost a third more time with the new mouse than with the old mouse. And the difference is huge. Now we give them the drug, and 30 minutes later, these mice suddenly remember the mouse that they knew before. And now to me, I don't know, I mean, I never know how like cool that is to people, but to me, that's really cool, you know, because the animal has a developmental abnormality. And we've done this kind of thing before with our interneuron, stem cell-derived interneuron transplants, but that's not reversible, and that's not titratable. In this case, the animals have a very focal injection of the virus, and they're getting expression of the DREAD only in these excitatory cells, so only those get downregulated, and we can titrate the amount of drug we give them, and 30 minutes later, their behavior is normalized. And I'm only showing one thing here, social discrimination. Actually, this has been done by both the group that I'm collaborating with, and also by other groups on a bunch of these different psychosis-related cognitive deficits. This isn't just about social memory. So we can actively change the circuitry in an adult animal, mammal, and immediately see, or shortly thereafter, see beneficial effects of that in terms of the specific behaviors that are related to the specific circuitry that we're manipulating. And then, of course, if we stop adding the drug, they go back to here. They go back to there. And so this is, to me, incredibly powerful. It allows us to start thinking about moving from the past, where we're giving a drug in the mouth that goes to every cell in the body, many of them, there is no receptor that's specific in the brain to one cell type. They're used again and again and again in many different cell types and in many stages of development. And we're moving now in a direction of being focal, where we can say, okay, this circuit is abnormal. How do we fix it? We can go in with a safe virus. We can affect only the cell types we're interested in, and we can affect them in a titratable way, a graded way, a little more, a little less, see what works, or stop if it's not working or we're worried about side effects. So this is, I think, where the future is for some of these, again, major mental illness. We're talking about the people with schizophrenia who can't really function. The medications don't help, and their lives are just very severely impacted. And this is my lab, and we get funding from your taxes, from the National Institute of Mental Health, the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, and from the Brain and Behavior Research Foundation, Schizophrenia Private Foundation. And I'll end there. Okay, so thank you. So it goes through the whole body, but since the receptor it's targeting is artificial, the receptor it's targeting doesn't exist in biology, and the drug is made very, very carefully to only interact with that artificial receptor. So it will go everywhere, but it'll only have an effect on that one place. Yeah, the problem with the psychosis drugs is they go everywhere, but they affect many different systems. I'll sort of work this way. Yes.
I thought I heard you say that it's not clear whether that part of the brain is the cause or whether the hyperactivity is like a correlation of something else that's going on. But yet you're targeting that area to change.
Yeah, and I would say that it almost certainly, when you mention cause, the question is what the root cause, like what was the, and sometimes I like to use the word the incipient etiology, and is like the root cause could have been an abnormal factor in the development of a certain type of inhibitory cell in utero. And as the humans develop and our brain changes, especially over the adolescent age range, there's changes to the brain that are quite substantial. And suddenly, the fact that that cell wasn't made right to begin with matters. And now the circuit becomes abnormal. So the cause could have been something that's ages before. And in fact, in the 22q mice, in the 22q humans, we actually think the cause has to do with their mitochondria in those inhibitory neurons. They're not making enough energy, and that means they can't maintain enough inhibition. But when we try to fix it, we're not trying to fix them, because if we try to like upregulate them, they're going to pop. They don't have enough energy to begin with, and we can upregulate them very briefly, but they'd probably get very sick. They wouldn't like that very much because they don't have enough energy. So what we want to do is balance the circuit by going at the other side. That's actually not the sick side. It's the side that's reacting to the incipient etiology, and balance it back. So that the strategy is really to focus on what's driving the symptoms in a proximal way rather than what's the root cause of why the circuit is abnormal. This strategy in medicine is used all the time. All the blood pressure medicines, none of them target why the blood pressure is high. They target a downstream effect of the high, of a effector of the high blood pressure to try to normalize the tension in the vasculature.
If it's blocking one circuit that's causing the bad symptoms, does it ever happen that there are other bad effects that are a result of that?
Yes, certainly. So one would, as all of this, like deep brain stimulation and transcranial magnetic stimulation, and is something like this this DREAD and AAV approach starts to be used, we're going to probably find unhealthy effects of that that are going to need to be adjusted. The incredibly important thing about this is because it's adjustable, it should be more possible than hitting the entire brain with something that affects all circuits to be selective. That would certainly be the hope. But you're absolutely right. I'm sure they're going to be unexpected negative consequences, and finding the right balance is going to be important. That's a critical thing here. The balance isn't so much just that, since we've only affected a few cells, hopefully we'll have more resolution to find the sweet spot.
Yeah, I may have missed
this. The 22, these mice have the 22.
Yeah. Yeah, 28 of the 40 genes.
Yeah, in that last set of mice, yeah.
So it's beginning to look like something that's relevant to schizophrenia, but it's not. It's quite different from it. But I think, I spent my life in schizophrenia research, running international conferences on schizophrenia research, and running my own department with 100 people working. And this is a qualitative change. This is a leap forward. Mm-hmm.
Oh, thanks. Well, again, I'm just sort of a reporter here. I'm involved, but all this stuff is, absolutely group. I could name 20 people who are more seminal in their contribution than me in a way, although my energy, I think, is having some impact. You got to have energy. Well, I think you can argue that if you want to say a circuit is like a specific one cell affecting one other cell in a very direct way, but I think when I use circuitry, we're talking about millions of cells affecting millions of cells. So when you activate the ventral hippocampus, there's a strong excitatory projection to the nucleus accumbens that then projects an inhibitory projection to the subthalamic nucleus, then has an inhibitory projection to the ventral tegmentum, which overexpresses dopamine, which is released in the striatum, causing the psychosis. And so, and that's the circuit. That's the level of circuitry I'm talking about, not the CA2 pyramidal neurons going after interneurons. And
some of the part of the brain that eventually, by circuitry, gets to the hippocampus.
Yes, well, and the circuitry is going to affect the entire system. So dopamine is very important in schizophrenia. I didn't mention it, but the antipsychotic meds all target dopamine receptors. And when you activate the ventral hippocampus, you cause an enhancement of release of dopamine in the striatum. But again, it doesn't happen directly. There's no dopamine in the hippocampus. It goes through this circuit. So they're kind of, I hope I got that. Yes. But, we heard from Mark enough, but not yet. No. But
mm-hmm. So could you imagine a treatment like this? I mean, you know, and yet he's been on these meds for decades now.
Right.
Can you imagine in a treatment like this that, you know, there could be a full reversal, or wouldn't he have had, you know, after decades of this kind of...
Yeah, you know, my own thinking about this has, I'm more optimistic that we can help. I can't imagine we can help every different facet of the problems related to schizophrenia simply by rebalancing activity in the ventral hippocampus, especially in someone who's been affected. They could have post-traumatic stress disorder, essentially, from having been psychotic on and off for many years. And that is, although it also can involve hippocampus-related circuitry, it's complicated, right? So, but on the other hand, the way that we can normalize the behavior in the rats and mice, and people are now, there's a group at Harvard working on this with marmosets, with primates, it's really surprising. I wouldn't have really hypothesized it would work as well as it seems to. And because people are starting to use this technology in other types of gene therapies, so the technology is moving forward, I think the point at where we're going to be getting close to people talking to the FDA about trying this in adult humans is not very far ahead, where the FDA can be convinced this is safe. A tricky part of it is going to be, is it how to get consent from somebody who is psychotic, and because they would be the ones you would try it on, or the people that are pretty sick, right? And that's going to be a challenge. But I'm optimistic that some symptoms that have been bothering people for many years could be controlled in this way and improve quality of life. I can't imagine it would improve, like fix everything all of a sudden. But I can imagine it really having a quality of life improvement.
Or allow you to either not take or take fewer of
them. Yeah, absolutely. Because all the meds cause other side effects, including cognitive side effects, you know, and sexual side effects. And you know, people forget, I mean, a lot with people with schizophrenia, they're much more normal, unless you live with one. They're a lot more normal than you realize. We like to think that, oh, there's this like muttering person on the bus and just keep our distance. But when you get to know them in the office or in the home, they care. They have loves and they have losses and they have emotions. And it's really scary how normal they actually are but what they suffer with. And so I feel like probably we can help for that group. I'm optimistic is what I want to present. You know, maybe I'm wrong, but I am optimistic. Yeah, so this has been done quite a lot now in animals of various sorts, including larger animals and dogs and cats and now the marmoset, this small monkey is used quite a lot. And it's also been used in humans quite a bit as well on various things. So you can put a little needle in guided by MRI so you know exactly where it is, and then you can infuse the virus at rates that you just know from practice are going to cause a certain diffusion of it that'll be restricted. One advantage of the ventral hippocampus I didn't show is that actually it has ventricles on two sides of it. So two sides of it, if it leaks in, it's going to go into this space of fluid, and that's going to cause, that's going to disperse. So maybe a little tiny of it might infect a cell at distance, but that's going to be like one cell. It won't matter to the circuit. So that's kind of a help with the hippocampus. But this kind of thing has been worked out quite a lot, at how much you can infuse, what rate, what concentration to get like X amount of diffusion and focality.
Single class of neurons or like any neuron to the injections?
Yeah, great question. So the viruses are not selective to specific types of neurons. They can be relatively selective to neurons compared to glia or compared to vasculature or compared to immune cells that are also in the brain. So that can help some. But they're not selective to neurons. You have to use a promoter element that will make it only be expressed in certain neurons. That you can do. But you're going to get the virus into all the neurons. It'll only express in the ones you want.
The artificial receptor, how is that affixed? How is that, the concept of the artificial receptor is something attached to a cell?
We have to go because we have the time button there, and Sarah is next, too. It has a signal attached to it to make a peptide that sticks it in the membrane. So
stay there forever?
Yeah. Well, it has to keep being made. It'll keep being made, though. Great question.